We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk show. This is hour two of the program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is our producer. Jason Croft is at the controls for this hour. Kyle Mabry was on hour number one. In this hour, we'll be doing that program that we call Talk to the Family Doctor. This is something that we do every other month on the program with Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family medicine physician from Carl in Urbana for quite a few years now. He's been good enough to come and be on the show to be a resource, an information resource for people who are listening. He deals with people of all ages in his practice, with children, with grown-ups, people who come with a variety of health concerns. So we're here to try to answer questions. We cannot do diagnosis. I always like to say at the beginning here, we've got to be a little bit careful about what we can do because the doctor can't see you. But it's a good opportunity, I think, to ask some really basic questions. And if you do have some concerns about your health, give us a call and you can talk with the doctor and he'll perhaps can give you some advice, some suggestions, and then you can take it from there. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. You can send us an email if you want, will-talk@illinois.edu. Whatever way you want to get in your question, that's great. Thank you very much.
Good morning, David. Thank you for having me.
Well, it is that time of the year now when we start to remind people about flu and about the fact that various kinds of healthcare providers around our area will be offering flu shots. So if you want to get one, now is the time to start thinking about that.
Well, it's a shame to start thinking about winter flu season, given the nice weather that we've been enjoying here of late. But this is, in fact, the appropriate time to get your flu shot on board so that your immunity kicks up in time for the active season, which is going to be starting here soon and will persist through the spring months. So if for individuals who want maximal protection, mid-October is a good time to get a flu shot. But any time in the fall or winter, if you haven't had it, is a good time to get it. So there are multiple places in town. Carl, Christie, Public Health will all be hosting flu clinics. Each have their own websites as to where the location is and the time that they'll be giving flu shots. But regardless, there should be multiple opportunities for people to get a flu shot. Many employers give flu shots to their employees, and a number of the pharmacies in town are dispensing flu shots as well.
Mm. There are now places, I think, as you said, that one of the big local drugstores has been offering the shots for a while, and now the big clinics will be offering them pretty soon. And then they'll keep offering them into, I think, at Carl, into December.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, offering them. And so the question is, I wonder, people say, well, you know, I'll get around to that. I promise you. And then it just doesn't happen. If you wait until November, is there a chance that you're going to get sick before you get the shot? And is there a good reason to say, well, let's get on that and let's do that in the next couple of weeks?
The major concern is just that you would come down with the illness before you got vaccinated. But if you haven't gotten the illness, then by all means, get vaccinated whatever time that is.
Yeah. And if you, say, for whatever reason, you get the flu, after having had the flu, is there a reason to go get a flu shot?
Not really.
No. Okay, so at that point, you might forget it.
But there is the assumption that you've simply come down with the flu that the vaccination is for. Now, it is possible that you would have contracted a particular strain that wasn't related to the vaccination, in which case still getting vaccinated for the other more common strains would make sense. It's just that there isn't any way to prove what strain you had.
And I know that I have talked to people who were determined who would say to you, you know, I got the flu shot, and then I got the flu. That they somehow think that you can actually get a flu shot, and then suddenly you get sick. You get the flu from getting the shot.
In fact, if you got the intramuscular injection, you're being vaccinated with a dead virus. So you cannot get the actual illness, influenza, from the vaccination. What people often misinterpret is their body's immune response to that vaccination. Fever, chills, that achy kind of feeling is a sensation generated when you rev up your immune system. And so in some instances, people have an active response to their immunization, but it in and of itself is not influenza.
Okay. We have a caller here. Let's talk with them. Someone in Aurora on our toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Yeah.
Yes, doctor, my question is regards to a hernia. Is there any danger of not having it repaired?
Could you tell me the location of the hernia we're talking about?
Oh, yes, you're absolutely right, because you might think it's an aorta or something. What's in the groin area.
Mm-hmm. An inguinal hernia?
There we go. Thank you.
Yeah. These are relatively common. They simply represent a little weakness in the muscles of the groin area that allow a little portion of the intestine to bulge down through that opening. If it's relatively small, not particularly uncomfortable, doesn't limit your activities from a medical standpoint, it's not something that has to be surgically repaired, but they can, in fact, get larger, simply become mechanically uncomfortable, and can be aggravated when people are physically active, bending and lifting will tend to put more pressure on the intestine, and it'll tend to bulge through that opening more commonly. The major medical reason to have a hernia repaired is to prevent what people refer to as a strangulated hernia, what we call an incarcerated hernia. That piece of bowel can slip through that opening, and if it gets stuck and can't retract, then that piece of bowel will in fact die. It will be very, very painful, and there is a potential risk for significant infection in that dead piece of bowel. And so in many instances, if somebody has a noticeable hernia, getting it repaired electively, typically as an outpatient, is a way of simply preventing that. But in fact, there have been many folks who have lived, you know, quite comfortably for long periods of time with their hernia. And so it sort of falls into the category of if it's bothering you enough to warrant doing something about it, it's probably time. As long as you're aware of the potential risk of severe pain and possible infection, and you get that attended to promptly, and most people would have a hard time ignoring it if that problem with the incarceration occurred. Otherwise, in the old days before surgery, men would frequently wear an external device called a truss, and it was simply a counter pressure to put a sort of a pad against that opening and keep the herniated portion of the bowel from protruding through. So there were folks who lived with them for quite a number of years.
When you mentioned about part of the intestine would protrude out and then die off, you know, would possibly die off or whatever, how would you know it would be quite a bulge out there if that were to happen, is that correct?
That is correct, and it will be extremely painful. It will be impossible to ignore.
Because mine at the present time is just kind of like a little goose egg there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a small little thing. But I was just curious. I mean, I had one repaired many years ago, and they put mesh in there. And, of course, now, unfortunately, I have the same problem on the other side.
Right. And that's fairly common, actually. And as you alluded to, the mesh is kind of like putting a patch on a screen door. There was an opening there, and you're basically patching it with this device to mechanically seal that opening.
Well, thank you very much, Doctor.
You're welcome. Thank you. Other questions are certainly welcome. This is the show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. We do every other month on a Monday, and our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family medicine physician at Carl in Urbana. So questions are welcome, whatever's on your mind, health-wise, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just for a moment, let's go back to flu, because I'm sure that there are probably some people who maybe they don't like the idea of the needle stick. And they have heard that there is an alternative to getting a shot. There's a spray, a thing that they spray in your nose. Why would one?
There are actually two alternatives. The traditional flu shot is given intramuscularly, so you know it's a fairly deep shot. And most people, you know, say, gee, I was sore, you know, the day after. Mm-hmm. They have come out with what's referred to as an intradermal shot, which is a very, very small needle that just barely penetrates the skin. And this is relatively new. It came out, I believe, 1 or 2 years ago and hasn't been used extensively, but it is an alternative to people who hate sort of big needles and big shots. Mm-hmm. The other one that you mentioned in terms of the nasal spray, the thing about it that's different is that's not a killed virus. The nasal spray contains an attenuated live virus, basically a weakened form of the virus, and it is only recommended for non-pregnant persons between the ages of 2 and 49. For otherwise healthy individuals. So if you are outside of that age range, you have other medical problems, or basically not a candidate for a live virus vaccination, you should still get the regular injection.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's see. We have another caller here. Champagne, and that would be line number one. Hello.
Yeah, hello.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, hi. I'm 56, and I've got a hiatal hernia where apparently about 50% of my stomach is up above the diaphragm. And I've got an appointment with the surgeon scheduled, and I'm just wondering what that procedure consists of.
There are a couple of different procedures. Probably the most common one is referred to as a Nissen fundoplication. This is now possible to be done laparoscopically, so it's a more commonly performed surgical procedure than it was in years past, where it was a big open procedure. But as you indicated, the hiatal hernia is a portion of the stomach sticking up through the diaphragm. This is frequently associated with acid from the stomach getting up into the esophagus.
Yeah, I've been having that problem. Then I was bleeding. Apparently, my hemoglobin level was down to like 5.4, and I'd have some blood transfusion.
I'd say that's pretty low.
Yeah, I was in pretty bad shape. So
typically, in terms of the surgery, the basic idea is to simply push the stomach back down below the diaphragm, and then literally snug that opening back up. They'll take some tissue and wrap it around the base of the esophagus where it goes through the diaphragm into the abdominal cavity. And so you're basically trying to push it back down, snug up the opening, and this should serve two purposes. One, it keeps the stomach from physically protruding up into the chest, which in and of itself can sometimes cause symptoms. But it also minimizes the chance that acid from your stomach gets back up into your esophagus, which is what most people associate with bad heartburn, or what's referred to as reflux esophagitis. So
they suffer from that.
Right. And many people notice a significant decrease in the need for medications for that as a result of having the surgery.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for the information. I appreciate it.
All right. Very good. Again, questions welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. You can send us an email, will-talk at illinois.edu. Anything else flu-related that you – so we talked a little bit about now. You know, now's the time. A lot of places giving shots. You can go and get them.
Well, in the past, there were various age groups and various medical conditions that – you know, were supposed to get a flu shot or weren't supposed to get a flu shot. And, yeah. and basically, it boils down now to if you're above the age of 6 months, and unless you have some very specific reason not to get a flu shot, virtually everybody is recommended to get a flu shot. Now, depending on your age and your medical condition, which form of flu vaccination you get will then be determined by that condition or age. But almost for everybody, there's something that can be done to help minimize their chances of contracting influenza. The one particular change this year that's kind of interesting, because the flu vaccine itself is produced in eggs, an egg protein. Mm-hmm. Previously, individuals who were egg allergic were told not to get a flu vaccination. And they've actually done some studies here of late looking at, well, gee, what happens to those people
if they
do get vaccinated? And a couple of interesting things. They said that individuals who are able to eat, say, scrambled eggs and not have a bad reaction can just go ahead and get a flu shot. Somebody who says, yeah, but if I eat eggs or come in contact with egg protein, I develop hives, but no other reaction. Even those individuals, if they're closely monitored and supervised immediately afterwards for approximately half an hour after their influenza injection, can go ahead and get immunized. Mm-hmm. Now, individuals who said, gee, my blood pressure dropped. I developed asthma. I was throwing up. I had to seek medical care because of an allergic reaction to eggs. Those individuals are still not recommended to get the flu vaccination. But there's probably a fair number of people who have been either allergic or sensitive to eggs, but the reaction has been relatively minor. And those individuals are now approved to go ahead and get flu vaccination.
Okay. So that's if you have concerns about that, it would be a good idea to have a conversation with your doctor.
Yes.
Perhaps see what the doctor thinks. He or she could make a recommendation. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you just want to make sure everybody you know gets a flu shot.
Around you.
Around
exactly.
Everybody around you gets a flu shot.
Right.
So that will also reduce your chances. Let's talk with someone in up in Sycamore. This is on our toll-free line 4. Hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Getting back to the subject of hernia repairs, I've had a couple of them done too, and they use the mesh. And I have heard recently that there were some problems with that mesh causing residual difficulty years later, and was wondering if you could tell me about that. I had both a umbilical hernia and an inguinal hernia repaired using that mesh, and I'm hoping that there won't be any problems in the future.
The problems that you allude to are not unique to a hernia repair, but any time you end up putting a foreign body inside the human body, there is some potential for interaction. Normally, they try to choose materials that aren't going to generate much of a response, but the other problem that can be run into is the fact that a physical object placed in the body can, over time, migrate. It can move. And so there have been some times when the mesh has basically moved into a position where it was then causing a problem. There were a large number of different products used for hernia repair, so it would be very difficult to make a generalization about what particular problems might occur. If there's a specific concern, you would need to check with the surgeon who did the operation, they would have a record of the exact product that was used, and then the FDA would have a list of any products that have subsequently generated concerns or recalls or that sort of type problem.
Okay. Well, what kind of symptoms could be expected?
Most of the time, something's going to hurt. There have been a few times when the wires have come loose and started to protrude, and they literally were poking someplace that they weren't supposed to. So in general, if you have discomfort in the general area of the repair, it's a reasonable thing to have reevaluated. If, in fact, you have no symptoms whatsoever, there's no reason to go looking for any particular problem, because nobody's going to say that you should have it removed if it's not causing you any trouble.
Well, I had these repairs done about 5 years ago, and I haven't had any problems whatsoever. Is there kind of a window of time where if you get beyond that, you're probably home free?
No, not necessarily. But obviously, the longer you go without having a problem, the probably the better it is. But I've seen some folks who've had problems with mesh-related repairs probably 10, 15 years after the case.
Okay. Well, I think that about covers it. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Well, thank you. Well, that, I guess, prompts the question, because there are people who have all sorts of things, medical devices that have been put into their bodies, stents and defibrillators and artificial joints and various kinds of pieces of metal when they've had injuries. And silicone and all kinds of stuff. What makes the difference between what a body will accept and what it won't?
In many instances, it's that particular individual's immune response to that. In other instances, it's a mechanical issue. If something, you know, physically migrates to another location and isn't in the place where it's supposed to be, it could cause problems. So in most instances, devices or substances that are used in the body are generally tested in advance to try and minimize the chance of the body adversely reacting to it. You know, at one end of the spectrum is, you know, the patient who gets a transplant of other tissue. And we know that if you don't do something to try and prevent a reaction, that they're going to reject that because of the body's immune system. At the other end are substances that are commonly used, say, with surgery. Titanium clips are used all the time. If you've had your gallbladder, your appendix, or a number of surgeries, those clips are left behind and seemingly are inert. They don't do anything. But again, what makes life interesting is that people are different, and you know, the vast majority of people may not respond to something, but one individual may. But there isn't any way necessarily in advance to predict that.
So you actually could, say, have somebody who had such a routine thing like, say, they had a knee replaced. And that, I'm not exactly sure what we're talking about there, but I'm sure it's metal, and I don't know if there's plastic or, you know, whatever there is in there. That something that for most people would work just fine, there would be individuals, their body would say, oh, wait a minute, what is this thing here? This doesn't belong here. This isn't me. And would have a bad reaction.
It's possible. Now, with joint replacements, most of the metallic substances used for that are fairly inert, so that's actually quite unusual.
Okay. We're close to the midpoint here. Our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family medicine doctor from Carl in Urbana. He's here every other month on a Monday with a show we call Talk to the Family Doctor, and that's the idea, to have it be a general, open kind of conversation. Whatever questions you might have about health, give us a call, and he will see if he can help you out. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, something I saved here I wanted to ask you about that's been in the news here, and I expect it'll be a continuing matter of controversy, actually has been for a while, is the blood test that has been recommended for men to screen for the possibility of prostate cancer.
Commonly referred to as the PSA.
The PSA.
which stands for prostate-specific antigen. And while that substance is, in fact, specific to the prostate, it is not specific to prostate cancer. So there are a number of conditions that could cause somebody to have an elevated PSA test. But it is the only test that exists that can potentially help detect prostate cancer. Mm-hmm. Within the medical community, it's been known for a long time that the PSA is not a great test, but it is, in fact, the only one we have. Mm. So at one end of the spectrum, you have nobody gets tested at all, and there will be a fair number of guys who show up symptomatically with late-stage prostate cancer who may not have a very good chance of surviving that, versus the other end of the spectrum where people are getting tested and treated potentially for conditions that wouldn't have killed them. So at that end of the spectrum, the treatment might actually be worse than the disease. The natural history of men's prostate is such that it gets bigger over time. The PSA test goes up over time simply to reflect the size of the prostate. And we know that if, in fact, men live long enough, they will develop prostate cancer. Basically, if you autopsied every 95-year-old guy who died and looked at their prostate, you would find prostate cancer cells in there. What we really need is a test to differentiate the type of prostate cancer that you can die with versus the type of prostate cancer that will cause you to die. Mm-hmm. And we don't have that. Mm. So part of the controversy right now is that the PSA is detecting cancers at a very, very early stage that may have just sat there for the next 10, 15, 20 years and not caused any symptoms whatsoever, versus the type of prostate cancer that would actively grow, metastasize, and kill somebody. And early on, we don't have a good way of separating those two out. So the choices for men who have had elevated PSAs have ranged from, okay, we'll just keep an eye on that and check it again later, to surgery, radiation, any combination of things to get rid of your prostate.
Yeah, it seems that from what I read about it, it seems that though that when men get the message that they have prostate cancer, that it's
pretty
difficult.
Hard to ignore.
Well, yeah, I mean it's difficult. There are a lot of guys that say, "Get that thing out of there." The watchful waiting, it seems kind of a hard sell, and. And one would think that in probably some of these cases that would be, as you would say, well, that would be perfectly medically appropriate to say, well, okay, let's see what's happening in six months, that we don't have to schedule for you for prostate surgery next week. Let's just take it easy here. But that I think a lot of guys, you say you got prostate cancer, that's you'd say, well, okay. Let's get on that. Let's do something about it. I mean, how does one counsel a patient about what the course of action should be?
Well, and that's just it. You have to take that particular individual's sort of philosophical approach to medical care into consideration, because as you just pointed out, at one end of the spectrum will be the gentleman who says, get that thing out of here and get it out now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they will want to have everything done to ensure that the prostate cancer is, in fact, gone and not going to be coming back. And at the other end are people who say, I've read about the side effects of surgery and radiation, and, maybe the treatment's worse than the disease, and maybe mine is going to be one of those that just sits there and doesn't do anything, and I'm willing to just, recheck it again in, say, 6 months, which is a reasonable time frame. But there's no right or wrong answer here, because we don't have a way of predicting which person should have had a major intervention and which person we can safely say, no, you just sit on that one and don't worry about it.
Yeah, okay. I'll tell you what, we have a caller we want to get to, and we can talk some more. Our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. This is our monthly Talk to the Family Doctor show, or it's every other month. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, we get enlightened with Laura Dern, who stars in that new HBO series, along with executive producer Mike White. Dern plays a businesswoman who returns from a retreat after a very public meltdown to try and mend her fractured life. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
WILL programs are made possible by the Champaign County Developmental Disabilities and Mental Health Boards, presenting the 5th Annual Reaching Out for Answers Disability Resources Expo at Lincoln Square Village on Saturday, October 22nd from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. The expo features over 65 exhibitors and entertainment for the whole family.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, and we have 10 different guests, 10 different topics every week. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, the guest is Michael Loudon. He is a geophysicist who works for ExxonMobil, and we'll be talking about energy in the 21st century. This is a program we had scheduled for last week. We were going to have him here on the show, and that morning we had a surprise presidential news conference we decided we wanted to run. So we sat down with Mr. Loudon in the studio and recorded the interview, and we're sorry that means we couldn't take calls, but we wanted to have the conversation, so you'll be able to hear that tomorrow. We're here weekday mornings, as I say, 10 different topics. You can check the schedule, listen to past programs by going to our website, which is will.illinois.edu. In this hour of Focus, our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family medicine doctor at Carl in Urbana. Every other month he's on the program, we talk about health, and he does his best to answer basic questions. So whatever's on your mind, you can try us out, give us a call, and he will do his best to help you out. A couple of callers here ready to go. Next up is in Urbana, and this is line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
My son is 4.5 years old, and he has chronic liver disease. He's got hepatitis B. And so we have him seeing a pediatric liver specialist about once every 6 months who checks his liver function levels. And at this point, he's recommended that he's in the mild to moderate level, so antiretroviral treatment isn't indicated. And my question for you is, and this is a question he hasn't really been able to answer, is whether or not there are specific supplements, either herbs such as like milk thistle or specific vitamins that, you know, would be indicated for, you know, someone of his age as far as just things that would help to strengthen the liver.
Personally, not aware of any type of actual study that would have been done in this age group. That's part of the difficulty with a number of pediatric issues is that there aren't enough studies around. A number of these things aren't very common, and two, there are obvious reservations sometimes by children's parents to participate in something experimental. But I don't have any references whatsoever for herbs or vitamins for liver disease in children. I'm sorry.
Okay. No, that's all right. Thanks thanks for taking the call, and I'll hang up and listen to the rest of the show. I really appreciate it.
Well, very good. I thank you for the call. Let's go to another caller here, and this is someone in Champaign. This is line number two. Hello.
Yes. If you're looking at PSAs, it seems that there's a preventative medicine issue. You don't get medical benefits for PSAs that are for a period before. It's not like you can graph a chart of, say, 3 years of PSAs. You can get one PSA a year on most programs, and then you don't really have a guideline from your graph to know what's going on. Could you say something about that sort of corridor up to a PSA that might look dangerous, like 5.5 or something like that?
Okay. PSA levels are basically normalized for age, so relatively younger men are going to have lower PSAs normally, and that number is allowed to go up to define a normal range that's actually bigger as you get older, simply to reflect the fact that the prostate gets bigger and we know that the PSA goes up. So in general, you need a higher level of PSA as you get older in order for it to be considered abnormal. One of the things that has been studied and is still being studied is the concept of PSA velocity. We know that the PSA is going to go up over time. Generally speaking, that's a relatively slow, gradual process. And the degree of elevation from year to year is usually modest. So there are studies being looked at in individuals where suddenly the PSA jumped a lot. Let's say a gentleman's PSA was always 1, and now it's 3, but the upper limit of normal is 4. What do you do with that individual? And the question isn't really, really well answered yet. In many instances, they will look for some other explanation for why the PSA was up. Prostate infection, bad urinary tract infection, something that might have affected the test result on that particular day. So in some instances, they'll just say, well, let's treat the infection and recheck your PSA later. And if it goes back down into the usual range where it was before, then it's assumed that the PSA was elevated for a non-cancerous reason. But if there isn't any other obvious explanation, some researchers have suggested that this sudden rise in PSA may be an indicator of increasing metabolic activity in the prostate gland itself, which may be an early stage for prostate cancer. If you had a gentleman in the right age range with a positive family history, you know, if he says, gee, Dad and all three of my brothers had prostate cancer, you might look at that pretty suspiciously. So the concept of tracking it over time is being looked at to see if the rate at which it increases may be a statistical indicator for more concern.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks. So it's my understanding that and we can come back to this issue of, you know, what are we going to do from this point on, but that the standard recommendation has been that for guys, you should have your PSA checked at 50.
Along with a digital rectal right. examination of the prostate right. itself.
And then, so at 50, then you get your, you try to establish your baseline at 50, and then the recommendation would be that you should have your PSA checked once a year.
Correct.
After that. So there's really, so to go to what I think the caller was asking, but there's no compelling reason to want to check your PSA more than once a year, unless maybe you suspect something's
right. If somebody has symptoms, if they have an unusual family history, if the first one isn't normal, you may check it again. But in the absence of a compelling family history or symptoms, once a year is plenty. You mentioned age 50. We will, in fact, start that process earlier in individuals who have a family history of prostate cancer. Basically, if a gentleman says, gee, you know, Dad had prostate cancer when he was 45, mm-hmm. we're going to start way earlier than that on this particular individual.
Yeah.
As a general rule, we're going to start about 10 years earlier than when it occurred in a family member.
Okay, but then if you had a dad who had prostate cancer and say his cancer was diagnosed when he was 78,
we would still start at 50. Correct.
Okay. Villagrove next for another caller. Line 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have a question about my husband. He has wears wool socks all year long. In the summertime, even with the wool socks on, his feet will feel icy cold to him, and they'll be cold to the touch. And at times, they feel numb. Now, not long ago, he had a test that I cannot remember the name of. This, something about the brachial, checking blood pressure getting to his feet, and it came out normal. What other things could be tested or should we be looking for? Possible causes.
The concern I think you're expressing is this a circulation problem? As a general rule, if somebody has excellent pulses that you can feel in their feet, it's generally not a concern. If you have concerns, or if the examining physician cannot really feel good pulses in the feet, a sonogram-type test can look at the blood flow into that area and give a very good idea as to whether there's any type of obstruction or not. If that's normal, then there's probably very little concern about circulation. The possibilities are there are people who just have cold feet, and it's in and of itself just them and not necessarily a bad medical condition. So if, in fact, he's been this way for a long, long time and nothing has significantly changed, then there's probably less concern. But in most instances, poor circulation into the feet is simply the end result of all the other medical conditions that we talk about when we talk about general cardiovascular disease, blood pressure, cholesterol, diabetes, smoking, exercise. All those things go into playing a role as to whether somebody's going to end up with blood vessel diseases. So
this has gotten progressively worse for him. In the last couple of, because he did not used to wear wool socks year-round. He didn't used to wear them at all at one point. And so that's what was concerning to us.
Well, I would probably double-check with his physician regarding whether the pulses are easily found, and if not, a sonogram test to look at the circulation should be very, very helpful here in defining whether there's any type of blockage there.
Okay, I believe that's what he just had done. So my question is, what else do we look for?
You're just telling me maybe nothing. What you described was probably a test related to blood pressures in the arm and the leg.
Oh, okay.
And not specifically a sonogram test.
Okay. So that's what we'll ask about next.
Okay.
Okay, thank you for
your
help.
Thank you. And again, let's see, line one, and this is Champagne. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Good morning.
Uh-huh.
My husband has been having pains in his upper body, and because he had successful bypass surgery many, many years ago, and thank God it's still working, at first they thought it might be something that would require an angiogram to look at, and especially it happened after he ate. He would get these pains, and so they did a stress test where they give you an injection, and it speeds up your heart only a little, and the machine takes a picture of what your arteries are doing. I can't remember the name of the test. It's not Dobutamine, is that what it was?
Dobutamine.
Dobutamine,
mm-hmm.
Thank you. It was not that. And they found nothing. And then they did an ultrasound on his gallbladder, and that proved okay. But just to be on the safe side, his primary doctor ordered the same kind of test on the gallbladder to see what was working, and we just discovered that that showed nothing. And so I was thinking about the fact that he had a hernia done right where the surgery was about 5-6 years ago. And they did a patch. And so I was, he's going to be seeing his doctor at the end of the month, a primary doctor. And I wonder if this is something he should bring up, is perhaps the patch is not doing what it should. It was about maybe 6 years old. And also to ask you, what is the difference between a CAT scan and an MRI when looking at the tissues of the upper body?
Okay. Your last question first. A CAT scan uses X-rays, and certain parts of the body show up well with X-rays, and other parts don't.
What are those parts that show up well?
Bone shows up very, very well on a CAT scan. Soft tissues, muscles, tendons, ligaments, don't show up as well.
How about organs?
Again, depends on whether the scan is done with or without contrast. Contrast is dye that's injected as part of the test. The MRI uses magnetic waves instead of X-rays to visualize parts of the body, and again, can be done with or without contrast, but in general is more sensitive to the soft tissue structures of the body as opposed to the bony structures of the body. So depending on what you're looking for, occasionally one test over the other is a little bit better to see sort of what's going on.
Which one is best for organs?
Again, depending on which organ and whether you're using contrast or not.
How about liver? His stools are often white.
Liver can be identified very well with contrast on an MRI, and generally will give you a very good picture of what's going on there. In many instances, you also need laboratory testing because the picture of an organ will not necessarily tell you how well it is functioning. In many instances, I ask people to think about, you know, if I show you a picture of a car, you can tell me whether a wheel is off or on, but you can't tell me how well it runs.
Right.
Okay, and that's kind of the difference. When we visualize certain structures, we can look at it and see if it looks normal, but in many instances, we have to do something else to figure out if it's functioning normally, and those are two different things. The other possibility, if his symptoms are occurring after eating,
he's really cut down on the amount of food he eats, and his meals are much, much smaller. But he still, you know, feels great discomfort.
Right. And in some instances, problems related to the esophagus and the stomach themselves can produce these types of symptoms, and neither CT scan or MRI usually is very helpful there. What typically is more useful is endoscopy, where they actually look down inside, because the inside portion of the esophagus and the stomach are difficult to visualize on most imaging studies.
Okay, so that may be something to talk to his primary care doctor about.
Correct. The fact that he's had his previous hernia repair, even if that's part of, even if that wasn't working right, I would not normally expect that to be something aggravated by eating.
Okay. You have just been very helpful with lots of really good information, and I truly appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Well, thank you.
We'll go one
more at least. This is also someone in Champaign. This is line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Okay. I'm very frustrated. I have like a head cold that goes on and on and on, and I can be sitting here like in my house, everything's fine, reasonably fine, and then I start sneezing like 6-7 times, really loud, and I've been to the doctor twice, and they gave me like allergy tablets and that sort of thing. And is there anything else, or is this unusual that this goes on and on and on, it seems like?
Well, as a general rule, a cold, if we're talking about an upper respiratory viral infection is usually self-limited. It will, you know, run its course over, you know, a week to 10 days. People have a little fever and nasal congestion, a little cough, and, you know, it basically runs its course and goes away. If you're continuing to have congestion, sneezing in the absence of fever, and these are persistent symptoms, it's much more suggestive of an underlying allergy. And this is, unfortunately, a peak time of year for many allergies. What people refer to as the hay fever season usually starts in mid-August and goes through the first hard frost and tends to be aggravated by the farming activities because the harvesting puts a lot of plant material and dust up into the air. And so when somebody has persistent symptoms, especially in the absence of fever, we become a little bit more suspicious about allergies. There's certainly more things than just, you know, over-the-counter antihistamines that can be done for the treatment of allergies. So I do think it would probably be reasonable for you to revisit with your physician your progress to date so far and see what are some of the other possibilities might be.
I also, might mention that, like a couple days ago, with constant blowing and everything, it's turned out with a little blood in there, too, on and off the last couple days.
Well, if you get it raw enough, it's going to bleed. And so that in and of itself isn't necessarily surprising.
If I get it wrong, you said?
If you get it raw. If there's constant drainage, frequent blowing, frequent sneezing, the lining of the nasal passages simply gets raw and irritated, and it's not uncommon for that to bleed.
Oh, boy. Okay. Well, thank you.
All right, thank you. We're pretty much at the point we have to finish here. Just real quick, you know, we were talking earlier about the PSA test and the reason that I raised it, and it's been in the news and I'm sure it will continue to be controversial, is we actually have a federal task force, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, that has looked at this business of, you know, who do you test? What kind of treatment does that lead to? And their bottom line is they're now recommending that men don't get the PSA test, where before this, the standard, as I said, standard recommendation was, if you have no family history, at age 50, you should get your first one and then should get tested every year. And a lot of doctors are not happy about this, including the American Urological Association.
Correct. This is in the same vein as this group came out, I think it was last year or the year before, with the recommendations about, gee, maybe we shouldn't be doing mammograms at least as frequently or as often as we have in the past. And again, it was very controversial. And they look at the basically published data and make some assumptions on what are the costs to doing this, not just economic, but the cost to the patient, versus the benefits gained from screening. Because when we talk about screening, we're talking about the entire population. And so this will generate a lot of controversy. There are a lot of things yet to be decided. If there was a better test, we probably wouldn't have this controversy. And they are trying to refine this a little bit more, but it'll be a while yet.
Well, I'm sure we'll have an opportunity to talk about it again in the future. For the meantime, we'll say thanks to our guest, Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family medicine physician from Carl in Urbana. He's here every other month for the show. We call Talk to the Family Doctor. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, David.
What kind of treatment does that lead to? And their bottom line is they're now recommending that men don't get the PSA test, where before this, the standard, as I said, standard recommendation was, if you have no family history, at age 50, you should get your first one and then should get tested every year. And a lot of doctors are not happy about this, including the American Urological Association.
Correct. This is in the same vein as this group came out, I think it was last year or the year before, with the recommendations about, gee, maybe we shouldn't be doing mammograms at least as frequently or as often as we have in the past. And again, it was very controversial. And they look at the basically published data and make some assumptions on what are the costs to doing this, not just economic, but the cost to the patient, versus the benefits gained from screening. Because when we talk about screening, we're talking about the entire population. And so this will generate a lot of controversy. There are a lot of things yet to be decided. If there was a better test, we probably wouldn't have this controversy. And they are trying to refine this a little bit more, but it'll be a while yet.
Well, I'm sure we'll have an opportunity to talk about it again in the future. For the meantime, we'll say thanks to our guest, Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family medicine physician from Carl in Urbana. He's here every other month for the show. We call Talk to the Family Doctor. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, David.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the U of I Office of Public Engagement, supporting the Campus Charitable Fund Drive. Each year, contributions from U of I employees on the Urbana-Champaign campus help support 11 social service agencies and other nonprofit organizations. Information on how to give is on the web at ccfd.illinois.edu.
And that's it for us in Focus. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 98.9 FM, HD3, Urbana. Online at will.illinois.edu. In Kansas City, December wheat trading at 688. That's up 3.5. March, 703.75, up 3.25. December wheat, Chicago, 613, up 5.5. March, 648.25, up 4.25. December corn, 607.5, up 7.5. March, 619.5, up 6.75. May, 626.75, up 6.5. July, 631, up 6.75. November beans, 1178.75, up 20.5. January, 1190, up 20. March, 11.